Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today we have a special part two episode on the UFO breakthrough with Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Now, in part one, we covered Linda's inside information that led her to conclude that an imminent announcement of life beyond the Earth was going to happen in 2016. In part two, we investigate 75 years of UFO secrecy that has led us into a two-tiered society with a small group of insiders controlling the energy economy with advanced technology. Now, in Linda's investigations, she's discovered that not only is advanced technology a major card the cabal may be holding, they may have also discovered the secrets of time travel and altering timelines to produce outcomes in global affairs, from politics, war, and the economy. Were they helped by an off-world source? Here we go, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. UFO secrecy, 1941 to 2016. 75 years of a celestial blackout.
Freemasonry was a huge deal in the evolving United States of America. That means that the Capitol would have held huge Masonic secrets. Cape Girardeau, the retrieval of the three extraterrestrials and their craft, going to Washington, underneath wherever this sub-basement is in the Capitol. The Freemasons would all have seen it.
You know, learning of an early case like the Cape Girardeau UFO crash of 1941 can give us some insight into how our political and military leadership understood the challenges and the benefits of the off-world presence since even earlier than we assumed. Leaders like FDR and Churchill opted for major secrecy in the midst of the dire circumstances of World War II. They may have even understood that their adversaries, the Nazi Party, may have also been in possession of this ET technology, which added to their zeal for total obfuscation and secrecy around the UFO topic. The national security state, which grew up around this wall of lies, has now become a government within the government. But in the 21st century, with public awareness growing about the off-world presence, how will this kind of obsolete secrecy be maintained? And how will this all play out? Let's go ask Linda Moulton Howe.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lie.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Linda, it's great to have you back for part two of the UFO breakthrough. Now, to pick up where we left off, we were discussing how our military and political leadership were guarding the secret of the off-world visitors and their advanced technology very close. Now, can you take us into this post-war period and what happened there?
They come out of the war, but they weren't telling their second, third, fourth layers of military authority. So when this three objects, they were three, not just one, they were not disks, they were triangular shape, they were called planforms. When they came down between July 2nd and July 5th or 6th, 1947, and Blanchard at the Roswell Army Airfield, we hadn't even divided the Army and the Air Force then. So Blanchard puts out like a straightforward guy.
A press release.
What if these disks that everybody has been seeing and reporting, Ken Arnold was making national headlines in June 24th, 1947, mm-hmm. literally around the world. Kenneth Arnold sees nine UFOs in the sky. That was June 24th. Count the days. 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 1, 2, July. 9 days after Kenneth Arnold is around the world in newspapers everywhere, 9 days, July 2nd, 3rd, 4th, is when these planforms came down in three places between Roswell and Corona, at the Trinity site at White Sands, 30 miles east of Alamogordo on the Indian Mescalero reservation, that poor Colonel Blanchard, what does he do? He tells his assistant, Walter Haught, we have to put out this press release. And one of these things in the sky has come down.
Right. Now, when we look at the first response before the cover-up, they actually put out this official press release saying that they'd recovered this disc. And that's a really amazing moment if we snapshot it there, because the truth came out with no filter for once. And that's a rare occasion. Now, we know the Cape Girardeau incident had happened 6 years earlier. So where can we see this cover-up protocol kick into place?
When you look at how Ramey, who was head, I think it was the 8th Air Force in San Antonio, how fast they knew they had a mistake, they knew they had a leak, they had intelligence, and that's the Marcel, that's the Jesse Marcel Sr. He was intel.
Right.
So they had some control, but Jesse Marcel was out gathering up pieces of all of this strange material that had symbols on it. And he may have been working for Intel, but boy, all of us would want to do the same thing. He wants his son and his wife to see this material that he knows is not from Earth.
Yes.
And that's the famous Jesse Marcel Sr. late at night getting his son and his wife and the son picking up and becoming, as Jesse Marcel Jr. said to me many times and gave me one of his demonstration rods with the purple symbols on it, that is what, as a kid, he was picking up this material that was so light that it felt like air, that you couldn't even feel it in your skin, folding it and looking at these purple symbols and remembering talking with his father. And then this is so interesting. We think of something that's metallic, something would be made out of, as being hard. Like if you picked up a piece of aluminum, it would be hard to do anything except hold it. He said, Jesse Marcel Jr., that his father handed him a piece of this silver. It looked like silver metal. It looks like silver reflective metal, but could fold up like cloth.
Uh-huh.
And Jesse Marcel Jr. experienced this. And then, so it's folded up. And then his father would start taking it apart and it would go back, not a crease, not a line.
Fascinating.
Looked just like it did before. So that's from a guy God rest him wherever he is, Jesse Marcel Jr. was such a wonderful human being. And so you know that Blanchard was out of the loop. The government had all of this experience and knowledge of everything that they had learned from 1941 in Cape Girardeau, that the neutronic propulsion device that they found in Cape Girardeau, it says, was handed to Robert Oppenheimer for application on the Manhattan Project, which is the development of the atomic bomb.
Oh, it makes you wonder.
It's dropped in July and August of 45. Was test, and in August were the Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that means that our most highly kept Atomic Energy Commission and the Navy was working with the AEC tightly. That's where all the original huge secrets went, Navy and the Atomic Energy Commission. And that the decisions to put a firewall, I mean a big firewall, around everything concerning our atomic bomb and all the secrets of extraterrestrials, of anything we were learning, into all things nuclear. That's how they've hidden this. The Navy and the AEC were working together. Everything goes, whether it's gathered by the CIA, which didn't come online till September 18, 1947. We didn't have a CIA. We didn't have an NSA. We didn't have a DIA. We didn't have a Pentagon in 41.
Right. And that's an excellent point, that these things were only in their formative stages and wouldn't come fully into being for another few years. But there's something else that's very fascinating in there that you mentioned, which is about Marcel discovering these I-beams that had hieroglyphics on them at the crash scene. Now, that has a correlation with what the preacher they called out to the Cape Girardeau scene describes, seeing hieroglyphics in the crash debris at the scene. So we can take a look at this and realize that the alien symbols are a recurring factor in all of these different incidents. Of course, later in Kexburg and R.E.F. Bentwaters, we run across this kind of alien hieroglyphics theme again. Now, from reliable testimony, we do hear that there were photos taken of the site and the occupants, along with the debris, at that time. So, since we didn't have a Pentagon in 1941, as you've pointed out, where do you think they would have taken that wreckage and those bodies back then?
That is one of the most interesting parts of Paul Blake Smith's new book. Because he goes in and speculates, based actually on a very interesting firsthand account having to do with Cordell Hull, who was the Secretary of State then under FDR. And the story is this, that Cordell Hull had a cousin, another reverend. This is Reverend Holt, not Huffman. Huffman is at the crash. Holt is a cousin of Secretary of State Cordell Hull, who goes to Washington to see his cousin. And the Reverend Holt, with the Cordell Hull Secretary of State, is surprised that his cousin, the very powerful Cordell Hull, says, "I want to show you something." And they go down, the phrase was, in the bowels of the Capitol, which most people have no idea.
Right.
They see the Capitol here with a grassy lawn, and they think this is the Capitol. Well, Paul Blake Smith has now found information in which there may be seven layers going down below the Capitol.
Wow.
Three of which would be the current 2016 subway system. Lots of people do not know that there are three different subway systems underneath the nation's capital that connect down underneath the lawn, the foundation, going out to Senate and House buildings. People don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is supposed to be deeper or somewhere off, and that if there are seven layers, as Paul Smith says, Linda, it means that there's more square footage below the nation's capital than there is above.
Oh.
This is where this story is so interesting, because the two daughters of Reverend Holt have gone on the record. They have gone on sworn testimonies that their father comes back from this trip to Washington and to the cousin and says that they go down into the bowels of the Capitol in a, quote, sub-basement. That's what they called it. And there are three large jars. And in each jar, there is a non-human. There's no bruising, no cuts. That's consistent with what Reverend Huffman, that the beings on the ground, there was no blood, there was no anything like that. They apparently died, as Paul Blake Smith has found from some people, the term was incineration from inside, from breathing our oxygen-filled rich atmosphere.
Right, right.
So nothing damaged, and that in these jars, it does not say that they were in silver crinkly leotard. The speculation, in its pure speculation, is if this is true, and why would the Secretary of State and his reverend cousin, why would those cousins lie to the families in this story reaches? I think it's that, but I do, and Paul Blake Smith thinks so too.
So if they had these bodies preserved, and maybe this is where you're going next, but we can assume they did autopsies then, and they examined their anatomy. They must have gained a great deal of scientific and medical knowledge from this incident. So why do you think they were put in these jars in such a strange location?
Because, as Paul says, this comes down in Cape Girardeau. The closest military operation of any kind was Sykeston, about 30 miles south. It was the military internal. It's MIA is what they called it, and I can't remember exactly what the acronym, but it was a military installation associated with the Army. So it's an Army military installation. And that is who, from every source that he has, the bodies, the craft, everything is cleaned up. The Sykeston Army group flies it out. Where did they go?
Exactly.
Okay, so that's where the speculation is. In April of 1941, without even a Pentagon, the most both sacred and the most protected building in the United States of America would have been the nation's capital on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. They were all Masons. The Capitol building, for reasons that are still not exactly clear, to all of those evolving presidencies from the Capitol was not finished till the year 1800. So between 1800 and 1941, the Capitol on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. was a huge focus for all the Freemasons. Freemasonry was a huge deal in the evolving United States of America. That means that the Capitol would have held huge Masonic secrets. It would have been built for and around Freemasonry secrets. It becomes logical that something in Missouri would have been flown to Washington, D.C. and transported into one of these underground facilities, because there would be military and security and nobody would ask any questions, no one would know. And are they still there?
Are they still there? Good question. Probably. You know, this image of them in these jars below the Capitol, though, and then the Masonic secrecy rituals associated with these buildings and this incident, this is really, you know, we need to explore this a lot further. But this story makes sense to me because this is a period before we had a Wright-Patterson kind of base to handle this type of situation.
And eventually, by the end of the war, Wright-Patterson, that would have been the most obvious choice.
Yeah.
But we're talking, I think often we humans, we fail to do the evolutionary trek, and we need to do it all the time. We need to go to a year. We need to know what conditions were at that year, and then we need to do the evolutionary trek to where the lens we're looking back. You can't take 2016 knowledge, politics, human workings, and say it at all. You can't look at 1941 through a 2016 lens. At one level, that may seem obvious, but so many people don't do that. They don't take the flexible point, drop what we know, go back and do the research of exactly what was prioritized, what was the working dynamic between FDR and Truman. This is another fascinating part of Paul Blake Smith's research. Mm-hmm. FDR and Truman were not friends.
Right.
And FDR goes through first 4 years, second 4 years, my God, a third, fourth year. You get up to the crash in Cape Girardeau. What was the situation in 41? This is so important. Harry Truman was a powerful U.S. senator from Missouri. He had this position overseeing Department of Defense budgets and programs. And he's getting ready in the spring of 1941. Literally, this crash occurs. Truman already was ready to do a big hearing, a congressional Senate hearing having to do with Department of Defense. And there's no Pentagon, remember that. So Harry Truman is bound into this whole huge thing about what does the United States government do with defense matters. It was called the office. It was the War Office. That's what we called it then, War Office. FDR is in his third term. He will start running for the fourth unprecedented term. No president before or after has done this in 1944.
Right. Remember? And he wins.
And he wins. And Paul Blake Smith says he's personally convinced from everything, the rich, rich, rich layers that he's got into to do this book. Cape Girardeau, the retrieval of the three extraterrestrials and their craft, going to Washington, underneath wherever the sub-basement is in the Capitol. The Freemasons would all have seen it. FDR, Truman, George Marshall. Marshall was a Freemason, a close colleague to FDR in this regard. FDR depended upon George Marshall, so did Truman, because what we're coming into is this evolutionary history of what happened between the election in 44 and 81 days later in April of 45, on the same day, April 12th, 1945, April 12th, 1941.
It is intriguing.
Exact same day that FDR dies.
It's such an unusual coincidence, and I know there's a further bombshell concerning FDR and his death. So let's get into that now. Why is FDR's death not quite how history records it? And we should keep in mind that when FDR dies, we're still engaged in World War II. You know, we're certainly winning in Europe because it's mid-April 1945, but it will be another 3 months before we drop the bomb on Japan and they surrender. So his death is somewhat untimely, and we have Truman ready to assume the office. Strangely enough, Truman is the senator from Missouri, where Cape Girardeau happened, and he's also the Grand Master of the Mason Lodge there. So an interesting combination, but what is it about FDR's death that is different from the official version that he died from natural causes?
In all of the research that has come out, a lot of people started talking in social media around the year 2002. as we'll say, the last decade and a half, where a thread will get out on the web. Did FDR commit suicide? Here come hundreds of people with various aspects coming through their father was a policeman, or their mother was a nurse, or whatever they are. It's been the last 10, 12 years, all of this other thread of information about FDR actually shooting himself with a gun. And what Paul Blakesmith, the hardest piece he's got, it was in a diary or written by the secretary.
All right.
FDR's personal secretary went with him to South Carolina for rehabilitation because FDR was suffering from a lot of things. He was suffering from heart disease and he'd had polio and there were all kinds of things. He was not a well person.
No question, yes.
But the secretary, this is a written document, statement, that before April, in fact, I think it went into back a year into 1940, he had gone two convalescent trips to this estate in South Carolina. And at one point before the second one, he said to his secretary that he wanted her to get him a loaded revolver. That was the, that's how it was written, a loaded revolver. And she was puzzled, but she's his secretary. It's not her place to say, Mr. President, why do you want a loaded revolver? She gets him one. The secretary gets him one.
Right.
You got to remember, too, that FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt lived two completely parallel lives. They didn't share the same bedroom. They didn't share much of anything. By that point, they were, she was coming into her own as a political person and a speaker, and she had her life. FDR was president for, and now coming into this fourth unprecedented term, they lived totally independent lives.
So he was actually closer to his mistress by that point.
It would be so interesting to know, and there's nothing about that in Paul Blakesmith's work about the April 12th, 1945. Was she around? The secretary was, and other people who were supporting, and the details of what Eleanor Roosevelt did. And you know what, Dan, you have to assume if FDR, Truman, George Marshall, maybe Forrestal, he became Secretary of Defense under Truman, but all those guys were in that mix, 41 coming up to that election in 44, that Eleanor may have seen the three bodies in the jar in the sub-basement.
Definitely.
She wouldn't have been shocked. She wouldn't have been outside that information. She would have been one of the insiders. And it would explain, she was, I believe, in New York, and she gets the word that he is dead. The official release to the public was a cerebral hemorrhage. If you take a gun and shoot yourself in the head, that is a cerebral hemorrhage.
Right.
So it wasn't a lie. The lie would be not going further to say he committed suicide.
Now, aside from the secretary's gun story, which is very compelling for sure, why do we think that he would have committed suicide? I mean, what was the reason?
Yeah, all of the details are the people who saw him and testified later in various things, diaries and all, they said that the head was not shown to anybody. It was covered up right from the get-go in the house, but not like not showing anything, which means nobody saw blood. Nobody saw anything. it was just said he died of a cerebral hemorrhage.
Huh.
But the biggest, most telling is probably Eleanor Roosevelt. She goes from New York and gets to South Carolina, and she closes down everything. She takes over. Nobody is to see his body, his head. She called for a closed casket in the train. Nobody was to see his body. This incredible figure in history, who you would have thought would have 10,000 people lining up for miles in Washington, D.C. to come and see him, that was denied. It was quick. It was fast. It was closed. And Eleanor was in control of all of it.
That is really strange. And
Paul Blakesmith takes all these little pieces of people who testified, with the secretaries being the strongest underpinning, that he asked her to get him a loaded revolver, and she did. And all of the mystery about nobody being able to see him, this great fourth unprecedented term in presidency. If they all, underneath everything that was going on, but there was this group of insiders that included Truman, Eleanor, George Marshall, FDR, who saw the beans in the jars, it would perhaps explain why Eleanor would have acted so quickly, so secretly, keep everything away from the public, because if he shot himself on the very day, April 12th, of the Missouri crash,
mm-hmm.
and there they, the insiders, would have the guilt of knowing and the public not knowing. And here it was on exactly the anniversary that may or may not have contributed, because here's another very interesting thing. Paul Blakesmith said that history says that Harry S. Truman, when he got the call that FDR was dead and he had to immediately take oath to become the president as the vice president, and that he was vice president because in 1944, all of the ET stuff was more and more and more. It didn't die with 1941. And Harry Truman would have been one of the few Freemason insiders who knew about the bodies in the sub-basement, just like Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State. There was this inside group, and they knew that they were dealing with technology. They knew that they were dealing with bodies. They knew that they were dealing with something that was extraterrestrial. It may have weighed on FDR. It may have been the reason why he shot himself on that anniversary. That's what Paul Blakesmith wonders. And that the Truman taking the reins, Truman, in the end, was the one person, in a very hard thought request by FDR. Truman did not want to be vice president.
That's interesting.
Everybody was shocked when FDR asked him to be. And it has to be this underlying reason. They were the ones that were on the inside of the jars, the ETs, the crash in Missouri, and all the stuff that continued to happen. Going in World War II, the Foo Fighters, they knew they were dealing with the same story, and that they got Oppenheimer, this neutronic propulsion device, to develop the atomic bomb. Can you imagine being the head of the so-called free world in the United States, the head of England, Churchill, George Marshall, the British generals, they all, it would be like trying to pretend inside of a war with a Hitler and Nazis and Vril machines and discussions of UFOs. They knew all of this. They knew that Hitler had announced to the world that he was going to cover the whole planet, was going to now be transitioned to a super race, Aryans, tall, blonde, and blue-eyed. There was a book written about it. That Hitler wasn't just going for territory. He wanted to populate the entire planet with blonde, blue-eyed, white-skinned
Aryans. Yeah, a race of white supermen.
And that FDR, Truman, and these Freemasons, they must have been beside themselves with two tracks of, or three tracks of knowledge, and that they weren't keeping this from the United States or the world because they had power greed motives.
Interesting, yes. And that's also hard to fathom through a 21st century lens, where secrecy now is really like a cancer on the national security state. But what would you say their reasons were for hiding all this back then?
They were keeping this from the world because they really thought that World War II was a war that would decide the fate of the entire planet.
Huh.
Probably that is true. That this was really one hell of a moment in history, like the 2016 note now. So was that war in 45, the dropping of the bombs. That was, I think, as most people say, that was our throwing the gauntlet down to the whole world and maybe to non-humans. We did this. We have this. We destroyed two cities. Don't take us on. That was the United States at the end of World War II.
No question, we were battle-weary and had really emerged triumphant in terms of leading the world and defeating powerful enemies. And it was the aftermath of the war and the death of President Franklin Roosevelt, along with the knowledge of the ET presence, that led us deeper into this labyrinth of secrecy and disinformation, the legacy of which, I guess we could say, is this shift toward centralization of control and a police state in modern times, and some of those trends that are leaning in that direction. So when we come back, we'll talk about the German side of this secrecy coin and how timelines, time travel, and even stopping time became the ultimate focus of the hidden ET research. Don't miss this. We'll be back.
Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Subscribe now and you'll have access to the complete audio archives to download or stream at your convenience. Receive advanced updates and discounts on Dark Journalist events. Enjoy exclusive subscriber-only content. Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
Sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, I say little saucer, it was a saucer, came flying over their heads, put down three little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up, and took off at a great rate of speed.
Dark Journalist will go there.
The national security state, which grew up around this wall of lies, has now become a government within the government.
Hidden technology.
So in other words, the possibility exists that you have here a machine that is manipulating magnetic fields on a planetary scale that has nothing to do with particle physics.
The black budget.
But there's no such thing as getting away from the corruption because it is literally... It is now integrated into every economy in the globe.
Geoengineering.
I'm talking about right down to the DNA level. Imagine that you have now put microprocessors and sensors, along with everything else, into every human body, every animal body.
For more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries, Visit darkjournalist.com today. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
And we are back. This is Dark Journalist. I'm here with Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Linda is giving us some excellent insight here in part two of this UFO breakthrough episode of how this covert program on the UFO question got its start from this World War II period and is looking more and more archaic and absurd in the 21st century as the gatekeepers of these secrets around advanced technology and off-world visitors double down on denial and duplicity. It's not a pretty scene, but slowly these secrets are rising to the surface. Now, Linda, we were discussing America taking the reins of world leadership. And how did we see ourselves in this period? How do you think the world saw us?
The Superman on the planet. We were king of the mountain. We were considered to be really decent, fair human beings.
Interesting. Of course, the German part there is a real mystery, and you've pointed out that the advanced development that the Nazis were working on at Peenemünde, it seems like it was extraterrestrial interference that was happening there, and it may be that this was a different group with different names altogether.
Peenemünde is, to me, one of the most interesting because of when in 1998, when I went to Florida, spent those 2 days with who people later, much later in 2013, were introduced to as Anonymous, but I knew him by his real name, and he asked me to call him Cooper, K-E-W-P-E-R. When I sat with him recording 17 tapes and heard about the evolution of his life from working for the Central Intelligence Agency with his cover in the Army as a cryptographer, but his check came from the CIA, his boss was the CIA in Langley, and that their whole focus was on studying extraterrestrial biological entities of various types, technologies on this planet. That was his job. And that the Nazi aspect to him was extremely important. His own boss at Langley had him come to Washington for them to go down, talk about another bowels of a building in Washington that none of us know anything
right
about. It's a huge archive underneath, basements and basements of archives the CIA has under its Langley building. And he said his boss was after one specific document. It had come from the UK. It was MI6 or MI5. It was in the 1920s to the United States when we didn't even have an OSS then, Office of Strategic Services.
Right.
When we went into World War One and Two, there was no CIA, right? So this would have been going to somebody in Washington in the 1920s from Intel in UK. And the question was, do you have any information about the silver disks that are rising out of Peenemünde in Germany? 1920s, keep that in your mind.
Huh.
And the description in the document coming from Cooper to me with his CIA boss in the sub-basement at the CIA Langley building, what are the silver, do you have any information about the silver disks rising out of Peenemünde, Germany? That is such an important piece. The ramifications are huge, which is what Cooper wanted me to understand. That something in Germany, how many, that's at least a full decade and a half,
Before Hitler rises.
On the world scene and World War II starts. And that the silver disks, from his point of view, as a man working for the Central Intelligence Agency from 56 to 60, that's when Cooper came into this.
Right.
His boss and the group that he worked with that analyzed extraterrestrial film, physical technologies around the world, that something that was UFO, meaning extraterrestrial, was rising out of Piana Mundi in the 1920s. And the UK was spying and sought and were inquiring to the Americans. That is a hugely important piece. None of us fully understand the implications.
Yes.
Cooper didn't pretend to fully understand. He was making the point. If Hitler came into World War II saying that he was going to populate the earth with blonde, blue-eyed Aryans and replace the Hebrews, which they did a big dent in doing.
Absolutely.
Who were in those silver disks rising out of Piana Mundi in the 20s? What was behind the rise of Hitler? Who today, in the geopolitical, territorial, conflicting puzzle that we are confronted with by so many different descriptions of non-humans, who are the tall, blonde, blue-eyed Aryan-looking ones?
Yeah.
What is their goal? Is there conflict between the Ebens, the tall blondes, the reptilians? If there is, are there geopolitical, territorial, conflicting regions of our Earth to this day? And if that were true, would it explain the wars of the Middle East?
Yes, excellent point. And I guess the question that's on my mind about this is, if we do get out of 2016 with the kind of announcement that you've been talking about here, you know, we're not alone in the universe, does it diffuse those geopolitical tensions or enhance them?
Would it have an impact on geopolitical territorial human conflicts that might have been inspired for a long time and provoked by competing geopolitical extraterrestrial goals?
I see. So they've likely been in the very heart of these global conflicts.
I am personally convinced that something like that has been happening on the planet for a long time. And when I have asked people that I think have had some kind of firsthand knowledge, it's with the Ebens, do they think that we really have an ally? Generally, people say, we think the Ebens are our allies, but we also know, this is a phrase that has been said to me. I don't fully understand it, but I'm going to give this to you. We know that the extraterrestrials, all categories, lie.
Oh, isn't that problematic?
So humans lie, humans deceive, humans battle.
Right.
Non-humans lie, deceive, and battle. Our makers, if extraterrestrial, have made a reflection of them. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised by that, but we've always hoped and assumed that extraterrestrials that can move through the universe would not be warring, that they would have passed that. But if their battles, as I've been told also, take place by manipulating minds and manipulating timelines, it would begin to explain the complex, baffling interaction of the non-humans with this planet throughout history, that they have warred through human minds and by manipulating time.
Well, that is fascinating to contemplate the idea that warfare isn't something that we invented. But that last part about controlling time and altering timelines is very interesting. I wonder if we can go a little deeper into that and how important that is to this whole scenario we're trying to get a handle on.
I know from Bob Lazar that our government in 1988 demonstrated to Bob Lazar They could stop time by a demonstration with a candle that was set aflame, flickering. They turn on an ET machine and it stops.
Wow.
The flame is there. The candle is here. Bob told me this himself. It was a demonstration of stopping time. You can stop time. How do you do it? Is it involved with gravitational waves? I think so. And what has been the biggest headline in the last 3 weeks? For the first time, human scientists have been able to get measurements of gravitational waves, even making a chirp sound in their technology. And why is this so significant? If you start with 1961, Betty and Barney Hill, up to 2016, and you look at all the people and everything that has been said about the propulsion and the technology of non-humans, doesn't matter what they look like, whether they're clones, whether they are hybrids, whether they're full prime intelligence. There's a bottom line. We are dealing with intelligences that know how to move through the universe point to point by folding space and time, and they do it by manipulating gravitational waves.
Mm-hmm.
That would show how far humans have been disconnected from the technology of extraterrestrials manipulating Earth for millions of years. But it means that humans and scientists have now confirmed the very ingredient that abductees have said is the way extraterrestrials move point to point, by manipulating gravitational waves. That has happened in 2016.
Right.
If we have more breakthroughs between now and January 1, 2017, and this is the year, this is the node, this is when this Earth is going to go either positive or police state, I want it to go this way, then in another year, you and I could perhaps be talking about finally the press conference of a million years, where an Eben, through a translator, is put on a stage with the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of England, the Prime Minister of Canada, the Prime Minister of Australia. Everybody is there to say, you don't have anything to be afraid of. They're now going to be working with us and us with them. And we are now going to expand to Mars and to other planets. And we are going to try to stop warring on Earth and heating our atmosphere to the point where we could threaten not only other plants and animals, but threaten human life. That's insane. Let's put an end to this. Let's move out now beyond earthbound clans and tribes. This is the century to do that. Otherwise, we could be the creators of our own extinction. That's insane. Let's not go that direction.
Well, that would be one heck of a press conference, no question about it. I know you'd be right there, too, in the front row. Linda, this has just been really amazing. And the enormous response to part one, I think, shows how timely your work is just now in this very volatile period of time. The new edition of Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1, is available at earthfiles.com. And really, this is an amazing book with so much depth and details in there. Of course, this interview and all of the other interviews with Linda Moulton Howe are available at darkjournalist.com. Linda, just outstanding, and thanks so much for being on the show.
And we should do another Dark Journalist
show. Oh, yeah.
But people who want to get in touch with me, email earthfiles@earthfiles.com. I really think Glimpses Volume 1 is an important book, with introducing the praying mantis, all kinds of things having to do with how many types doing which type of work.
It's just very compelling and life-changing work, but really groundbreaking at the time, and now just really enhanced to include all this extra information. So really fantastic. So Linda, we'll talk soon, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. I'm going to take off. I love you.
Well, you're welcome. And I love you too and all that you do. Thanks so much, Linda.
All right.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode on the UFO Breakthrough with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. You can find more deep interviews, documentaries, and special reports at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.